The Coin Week podcast is brought to you by PCGS. The PCGS members only show will be held from Wednesday, February 22nd to Friday, February 24th, 2023 at Park MGM in Las Vegas, Nevada. PCGS members can take advantage of this exclusive event to buy and sell coins, have their coins graded on site, and talk directly with PCGS representatives who will be on hand to answer your questions. What would you do if you were the director of the United States Mint? Or maybe, let me put it this way, what could you do if you were the director of the United States Mint? Well, today on the Coin Week podcast, we talk to David J. Ryder, one of the few individuals to have held the job twice. We discuss his focus on collectors, the decision to redesign the American Silver and Gold Eagles, how COVID impacted the Mint's production and distribution capabilities, and that controversial privy mark that a majority of you got really mad about. We talk about all this and more next on the Coin Week podcast. Well, hi, David. Thank you so much for joining me on the Coin Week podcast.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it. It's always fun talking to you guys, and I enjoy talking about the United States Mint.
So, David, as Mint Director, you know, you served two terms, a stint lasting a little over a year during the George H.W. Bush administration, and then a longer, I guess, a full term under President Trump. In either stint, did you have any personal interactions with the presidents? And if so, what were the reasons? And did you find out either one of those gentlemen had any interest in what was happening at the Mint?
The answer to that is yes and no. My first stint, I had worked for George Herbert Walker Bush, who was the president who appointed me back then. I had worked for him for quite a number of years. Before I became Mint Director, I traveled all over the world with him to quite a number of places, got to know he and his family and his wife, Barbara Bush, quite well. And because of that relationship that I forged early in the 1980s when he became vice president, he later on then appointed me many years later when he became president to become the 34th director of the United States Mint. Which I very much appreciated, and I didn't last very long because he was beaten by Bill Clinton, President Clinton, and I soon left in favor of Phil Diehl taking my place, who did a great job. As far as my second stint, I was then 25 or 28 years older. I had successfully helped build a business, and we sold it to the Honeywell Corporation. And I was, quite frankly, looking for something to do. And President Trump, I have a dog that is barking. But President Trump appointed me as the 39th Mint Director. I did not know him, and quite frankly, I never met him. But he appointed me, and I was confirmed by the United States Senate unanimously, and served for him for a period of time.
So I guess in both stints, you probably worked more closely with the secretaries of the Treasury and not the chief executive. Am I correct?
That would be correct. For my first stint, it was for Nicholas Brady, Secretary of the Treasury. His family and my wife's family go back quite a long ways. We've stayed close. He and I continue to talk to this day. As for the second term, it was Secretary Mnuchin. And Secretary Mnuchin was quite involved in the United States Mint. He and I talked quite regularly. We met once a week. He pretty much approved everything that I did and was very involved in the United States Mint. It was quite nice to have his involvement. He was quite a taskmaster. He asked a lot of questions, and he and I got along pretty well. And he pretty much approved everything that I wanted to do, with the exception of a couple things. And it was quite enjoyable to work with him.
So I think when it comes to Secretary Mnuchin, one of the perhaps one of the Mint related things that the media covered in great detail, and maybe too much so, was he took a trip with his wife to Fort Knox, I guess to inspect the bullion depository. Were you with Secretary Mnuchin on that trip?
I was not. I had just come on board. I was in the process of being confirmed. I know about the trip very well, but he had done that trip probably 3 weeks, a month before I had come on board.
What were the if you're able to talk about it, what were the reasons for the trip, and what did he make of seeing the America's bullion I guess vault there at Fort Knox?
As the Treasury Secretary, he oversees all aspects of the United States Mint, and he and Speaker McConnell and the governor of Kentucky all wanted to come at his invitation to take a look at the vault. Not very many people are able to go inside. It's quite a restricted location. I've been there quite a number of times, but as the Secretary of the Treasury, he wanted to check it out. Is also he spent time meeting with the speaker and the governor and had a very enjoyable visit. I signed his name into one of the vaults. I signed mine right underneath his later on when I came to visit, and he quite enjoyed it. It's still a very memorable visit for him.
Speaking of Fort Knox, it's just one of those subjects that I think for some people, and it's I think it's probably a safe thing for most people to have a earned distrust of the government. But Fort Knox is one of those things that is just steeped with conspiracy theory and all of that. We did a video with Ed Moy, who discussed quite a bit of detail of his visit to Fort Knox to kind of allay some of these theories. But what would you say like stands out, or what are some of the big misconceptions about Fort Knox that you're able to disclose? Because it is a highly sensitive location.
Well, it is a highly sensitive location. They've got a lot of good men and women who work there as a police. Mr. Booth, who is the inspector there, is an old friend. It's pretty secure location. They've got a lot of things to protect that facility. It's hard to get into. No one, quite frankly, really ever gets into it. With a very small exception, the security is everything that it's made up to be. A lot of the vaults are below ground, and a lot of the security is above ground, both underground and around the fencing and various other locations. When I got there the second time, one of the things that I wanted to do was replace the American flagpole, which used to sit on top of the building. I wanted a larger flagpole that sat right out in front and flew a big flag, which we got done. But overall, it's a very secure location. There's a lot of interesting things over the year that have been stored there. Not to mention one that I always enjoyed was General Patton's two pearl-handled revolvers that they asked to store there while his museum was being redone. It was quite an interesting thing to have there, but there is definitely a lot of gold, and there's some other things stored there that I can't really talk about, but it's definitely a very interesting location for sure.
Do you have any specific memories that stand out from your first stint at the Mint before Phil Diehl took the position? Because I understand that when Phil comes on, he had to do quite a bit of reorganization of the mints, and then he was working to gear up for the dollar coin production, which was actually a topic you were against. You served on the Save the Greenback campaign, advising against the release of a dollar coin, saying that the savings were illusory. But what we get into that after you sort of touch on anything that stands out from your first stint.
Well, first of all, I was fairly young. I was 36 years old, I believe I was at the time. I had spent time as the Deputy Treasurer of the United States, which is what, and when Donna Pope was leaving or retiring, I was asked to replace her as the next Mint director. It took quite a long time because Senator Cranston from California, who wanted coin redesign, and Secretary Brady, and quite frankly, then President Bush, did not want to go down that road. It ended up being the right thing to do. Phil Diehl did an excellent job in creating the quarters program and creating a lot of new designs over the years. I fully embrace it right now. But at the time, I was kind of hamstrung, and I went along with what my bosses were telling me to do, which was no coin redesign. And Senator Cranston held me up for probably a year because of that. And then President Bush did what was called a recess appointment later on, after having served as the acting Mint director for some time. And then he did the recess appointment, and I became official.
So, speaking of the redesigns, this is a definitely an issue I think that numismatists are more concerned about than maybe the general public. Do you think it was perhaps a mistake to start to memorialize presidents and political figures on the obverses of American coins? Because if you really think about it, we're over 100 years with the Lincoln cent. Washington is going to be on the quarter for 100 years in about a decade. And we've sort of created an imperial coinage sort of inadvertently, because I don't think there's any political gain to lobby to remove Lincoln from a penny or Washington from a quarter, because these are such important historic figures. But we're also at this point, we're putting political figures on coins for decades and centuries, and they serve four-year terms. And then after Roosevelt, we limited the number of terms a president could serve to two for the very reason of trying not to create an imperial presidency. So it seems like our coins run kind of counter to like the democratic ideals that the country was founded on. And that's sort of my opinion, but it's an opinion I think shared with many coin collectors.
I agree with the fact that our coins and the images on our coin were selected for a very important reason. They were the founders of our country for the most part, and they serve a pretty good purpose, and they still serve a pretty good purpose today. But to your point about coin collectors, when it became my turn in my second term as Mint director to create a quarters program, one thing that your collectors may have heard, but probably not to the extent as much has been released in the media, is after the famous American Women's 4-year quarter program is over, we're going to do the United States Mint is going to redesign all the obverse and reverse of all the nation's circulating coins, the penny, nickel, dime, quarter, half, and the dollar. For 1 year only, representing the 250th year celebration of our country in 2006. So that's going to be an excellent chance, from my point of view, to get new collectors involved in the hobby, who young kids primarily, who are going to have a chance to collect a series of circulating coins that are going to be emblematic of the United States of America's first 250 years. It's going to be Ventris Gibson's responsibility to select all those various designs, and Joe Mena, our chief engraver, and all the other artists that through the Artist Infusion program to do all the artwork for all those. I think it's going to be an exciting time for coin collectors, and to your point, it's going to change the coinage for the first time in a very long time to a very large degree. I think it'll be a fun, interesting time for the hobby, and hopefully attracting new coin collectors to this wonderful hobby of coin collecting.
Well, let's touch base again on the dollar coin versus dollar bill debate. So, like I said, after your first term, you did serve on an advisory committee for a lobbying group trying to save the $1 bill. I'm sure you remember. And so at the time, I think you were quoted as saying something about how seniorage is an accounting trick that the Treasury uses to show that it's saving money, but it's sort of an illusion. So that I guess you didn't see that the benefit of a dollar coin versus a dollar bill as being worth eliminating one in favor of the other. Do you still feel that way?
I was part of a group back then to also have legislation passed for the United States Mint to run on what's called the Revolving Public Enterprise Fund, which really allowed the Mint to operate on the seigniorage, or the difference between the face value of a coin and what it costs to manufacture, permanently, and not have to go to Congress and ask for congressional budgetary handouts to run the United States Mint. I think that finally got done right as I was leaving, right when Phil Diehl got appointed. And it's been quite a successful program to where the United States Mint, unlike many other government organizations, does not operate under federally funded funds. It operates on the profit it makes on seigniorage. And I think during my last term is my last year in 2021, I think it was, I think we returned close to $500 million to the general fund on a lot of the profits that we made on selling circulating coins and numismatic products and so on. So while I may have been young and naive at that time when the dollar coin or the dollar was being debated and so on and so forth, I'm fully supportive of the seigniorage responsibilities that the Mint has entrusted to.
But what of the dollar bill, dollar coin debate? I mean, do you, it seems to me that you can't really have the coin if the note still circulates. And we are running into a situation with inflation where, you know, the coins have lost so much purchasing power that it's almost becoming an obsolete medium. And if we continue to have low value circulating currency notes, then there is no room for there to be, you know, like a dollar coin, a $2.50 coin, or whatever kind of machinations like you'd come up with to keep coins relevant in commerce. It seems like a big problem that I don't think I've heard anybody in the Mint director position who's living, who I've talked to, address like what exactly the future holds for the Mint if it can't start to produce coins that are more relevant to commerce.
Well, it's first of all, the United States Mint operates on the coinage it has been producing for 200, almost 250 years. I'm of the belief, quite frankly, when a lot of people start talking, let's take the penny, for example. That denomination has been tried to, that people have been trying to get that out of circulation and stop manufacturing. It's a negative impact because it cost 2.5 pennies thereabouts to manufacture. And when Secretary Mnuchin interviewed me for the job, he asked me that very question: should we start getting rid of the lower denomination coins? And for the penny, there's a lot of things that would go into that decision. The Federal Reserve has pushed rounding issues to round up or round down. There's a quite a number of reasons why to do it, but there's also a number of reasons that really haven't been talked about on why not to do it. I'm in favor of not doing it for the simple reason of how much it would cost the American taxpayers to do it. We did an attrition study at the United States Mint when I was there, and believe it or not, there's about 500 billion pennies still out in circulation. The Federal Reserve has for all intents and purposes, up until COVID, stopped stockpiling coinage. And with that many pennies, for example, out in circulation, it would take, and with no banks having the ability to take in pennies, if they were to eliminate the pennies, it would create quite a huge problem to get rid of that many pennies, in currently out in people's piggy banks and their drawers and their big jars and so on and so forth. I also remember talking quite extensively to a very large retail outfit that pretty much serves all commerce throughout the United States. And I asked them that question about rounding. What would you guys do, or what would you be forced to do if rounding all of a sudden became an issue with say the penny or the nickel, those two denominations? And their answer, because of the size and the of this particular retail box, big box store, kind of surprised me that they would probably eat the cost, which was something in the neighborhood of $30 to $40 million a year that they would have to eat, because they were not going to force rounding onto their customers. And you know as well as I do, any of those large outfits are going to round up. They're never going to round down. And to me, the Fed didn't agree with this comment, but for me, that's a forced tax on people who can least afford it. And the fact of the amount of cost and the expense of developing a system to be able to reclaim all of that product is would have been a huge, huge undertaking. And Secretary Mnuchin was not willing to go down that road. And it's quite an extensive study that we did when I was Mint director. And I think it's the right decision. Will that decision last over a period of time? My guess at some point there will be legislation passed to probably eliminate it and go to higher denomination products. But I don't think that's going to happen anytime soon.
Do you think then, like, and obviously, I think we all understand that it's the Congress of the United States that determines which denominations get struck. I mean, as the Mint director, you may be able to give your opinion and produce some reports, but you can't tell the Congress to create anything.
Right.
But I mean, is it your opinion that we have the right circulating denominations currently, or I mean, or in your sort of idea of what the mint could produce and what would be viable circulating coins, do you think, that there needs to be some change? I mean, you do have a half dollar that doesn't circulate, a dollar coin, which really hasn't taken off. So we're really looking at, like you said, a penny, a nickel, a dime, and a quarter as the primary linchpins of our circulating coinage. And it's just like I said, the purchasing power is, it's probably a fraction of what it was like even 20 or 30 years ago.
As time goes on and e-commerce comes in and all of the different factors that are weighed for these types of decisions, you hit the nail on the head. It's Congress' responsibility. If Congress wants to change the coinage, it's their responsibility to do it. It would be my responsibility and the Secretary of Treasury's responsibility to educate those various bodies who would consider something like that on what's the pros and cons. And there are definitely pros and cons that support both sides of the story. My job would simply be to educate. Am I in favor of one way or another? I think the system we have works pretty well. Is it getting antiquated? Probably. Could there be some changes done down the road? Probably. But I don't think that's going to happen anytime soon.
Well, one change that did happen during your second term was the Mint's decision to redesign the bullion program, the Silver Eagle and Gold Eagle program, to introduce new anti-counterfeiting measures. I'm told that is some of the work of the Anti-Counterfeiting Education Foundation played a role in your decision to move on that. Is that correct, in your opinion?
Well, I did have a company that we sold to Honeywell that was in that business, primarily in the banknote business, quite frankly. Coinage at that time, when we had that company, wasn't an issue. Interestingly, after I left the sold the business and stayed with Honeywell for about 10 years, 10 or 12 years. One very famous mint had a problem with counterfeiting. That was the British Royal Mint, and we helped them introduce a new anti-counterfeiting feature that is now in all the British 1 pound coins, and they have sold that technology, I think, to other central banks in the world. But it's a bit different than what we decided to do with the American Eagle bullion program. There's always been issues. Beth Dyshear and people like that have been talking about counterfeiting problems with the bullion program for quite a long time. And I hear it. I listen to them, and we decided when we decided to make the changes to the bullion program after 30 plus years, that we were going to add anti-counterfeiting features. And I employed a whole staff of very bright people at the Philadelphia Mint. We installed a very sophisticated anti-counterfeiting lab, and as it turned out, we did have a problem with counterfeiting of the United States quarter that was being rapidly counterfeited in China, and we did quite a lot of work to resolve that issue, mostly with the process of mutilated coins that the Chinese would manufacture a quarter and then mutilate it and try to push it through our mutilated coin program. So we got on top of that program. We changed the rules, changed the legislation, and pretty much have solved that problem with counterfeiters counterfeiting our quarters. With regard to the bullion anti-counterfeiting program, we implemented a number of things that were easy to do and not costly to do because of the volume of what we produce. We did some interesting things, both obverse and reverse, and some overt and some semi-covert. But I think we did the right thing, and what we decided to do didn't cost a great deal to implement. I think it's working very well.
So you were on hand for the ceremonial strikings of the last of the old type and the first of the new type. How did you feel seeing such an iconic coin undergo that change and to sort of be the instigator of that change?
Well, I'm the instigator in chief, some people would probably say, but one of our staff people came to me and informed me that after a certain period of time of the product being in circulation, meaning the bullion coin, that we were allowed to make the change. And I presented that to Secretary Mnuchin, and he agreed to that change. And we then endeavored to make that change. I spent quite a lot of time, as did the staff, doing a lot of interviews and talking to a lot of people. And I remember one individual in particular, John Mercanti, that all your listeners will know. I called John personally, and I've known John for quite a long time. And I asked him the question because there was a lot of pros and cons. There were some people that wanted us to do it, some people that didn't want us to do it, some coin purists that thought that it was a terrible idea. There were some that thought it was a great idea. And John happened to be one of those that thought it was a pretty good idea. Was he sad to see his design go? I'm sure he was. But he didn't get in the way. He applauded it and embraced it. And we then, spent several years implementing that program, which I think the designs that were selected through quite a large number of different designs that were submitted, and absolutely beautiful designs, were the right designs. And I think they're going to live on for another 25, 30 years until some other character like myself comes along, and whether he keeps them or she keeps them and decides to do something that I did in 2021. I think at the end of the day it was the right decision, and it helped create new coin collectors and retain old coin collectors, and I think it did pretty much its job.
So speaking of John Mercanti a little bit, the Mint after Elizabeth Jones leaves had a period where there was no chief engraver until Director Ed Moyne appointed John to be to that position, and then after John retired, there was yet another sort of a latency, or there was no formal chief engraver at the Mint until Joe Minna was named chief engraver. How important do you think the job of chief engraver is for the engraving department? And do you feel like going forward, this should be a position that is always occupied by a talented engraver on the staff?
To be honest with you, it was one of the first questions I asked when I came back as Mint director. I was kind of surprised to learn that there was no quote unquote chief engraver. There was a very talented engraving staff, but no quote unquote chief engraver. And I asked immediately that that be changed, and we went about finding a new chief engraver, and Joe Mena was the person that I chose. And he's a very talented young man with a huge talent, quite a lot of education, both in Russia and other places in the world. He's a great sculptor. He's a good engraver. He's got a good rapport, I think, with Ventris Gibson. He had a great rapport with me. I pretty much let him do his thing. And I think he's going to live on for a long period of time. He's certainly young enough to be there another 10, 15 years, maybe 20 years, and have a lot of effect on the coin collecting community. I think his staff also enjoys him, and I think he's doing a pretty good job.
Yeah, we had the good fortune of I have the good fortune of seeing him at his workstation. I think it must have been during the period that the Lions Club commemorative was made. I went to see the coin striking ceremony, and I got to go upstairs. One of the real thrills of that trip is that they had the hubs for the 1964 Morgan dollar that was never produced. So I got to actually handle those objects, which was kind of a real thrill. I don't even know if they had been photographed or videotaped up to that point. I did want to ask one question from one of our readers, a reader, Tubasupio. I'm sure I'm butchering that. He wanted me to ask you, why did the gold eagles have the edge counterfeit device added to them, but not the gold buffaloes? Was there any reason behind that decision that you can remember?
I can't speak to the Buffalo. That was Ed Moy's project, and we didn't change that. I probably could have. They probably could do it now, but I chose not to do it. I figured biting off the American Eagle was probably enough. But as I said, if the U.S. Mint decided to do that, it would be something that they could do relatively easily, in my opinion.
All right, so you were a director in your second term, during one of the most, I think, challenging periods in the Mint's history, and I think with the COVID pandemic raging, and you'd almost have to go back to the Civil War or maybe the yellow fever outbreaks at the end of the 18th century for the Mint to be facing the challenges it had create, striking coins and getting them into circulation. Except the difference is that the modern Mint was making many, many multiples the number of coins that any of the 19th century, 18th century mints were producing. So, how difficult was it to meet the demand of the market and to keep coins in circulation? I mean, we did have a national coin shortage, and I'm sure that must have really played a huge role in your planning and the decisions you had to make as Mint director.
COVID was a very interesting time for me personally. I spent a huge amount of time dealing with it. And when it first hit, Roger Rapogal and I, who was then the head of the cash product office for the Federal Reserve Bank, and I started talking, and it became very clear that we had a problem brewing. And when COVID really got its teeth into America, we realized pretty quickly that the Federal Reserve was depleting the U.S. Mint stockpile, and I believe we had at that time, at the very beginning, 3 billion coins in our inventories, in our stockpiles at the Philadelphia Mint, and we depleted that in probably a week, I believe was the number. And the shortage was a real deal. But also what was a real deal was the protection of the United States Mint workforce. We spent several million dollars in developing programs to help protect our employees and safety and distancing and all the different masking and gloves and new touch methods of entering a bathroom or exiting a bathroom or touching a faucet. It goes on and on and on. And we were the only Met in the world to remain open during that whole process. That's been fairly widely reported on, but it wasn't for the sake of a lot of effort to keep the U.S. Met employees safe. We had a number of a low number of deaths because of COVID. We had some sicknesses, but we also at the very beginning rewrote our COOP operation plan, continuity plan, and rewrote the way that we were approaching the COVID crisis. And fortunately, I think we did a lot of the right things. We were able to keep the facilities open. We had one shutdown of West Point Bullion Depository for 24 hours, I believe. But our staff and the senior leadership met every day during the height of the COVID. I met once a week with all of the Federal Reserve Cash Product Office, as well as all the bankers around the country on a weekly basis. And I believe the Mint should get a lot of credit for keeping the coins coming. There was at one point, I think we produced 20 billion coins, which is a record at the time. And we kept the employees safe. They came to work, they did their job, through a pretty difficult period of time for the United States Mint. I think the proof's in the pudding that we did during that time also a lot of bullion coins. We had the Morgan Silver Dollar that came to bear. We had the new Eagles coming out. So we were pretty darn busy there for quite a long time, but we kept everybody safe doing it.
And it seemed that the COVID period, especially when many people were either, I wouldn't say locked down, but working from home, working remotely, it seemed like that was a boom period for the rare coin and modern coin industry, as people had all this, let's just say, unsupervised work time, and they were able to do some internet shopping. Were you expecting to see like such a demand for coins during this period?
One of the things that I wasn't prepared to see is the size of the demand, and because of the metal shortages that we had, some people would say that I was using that as an excuse, but we've had serious shortages that we still have today on coin blanks, silver blanks, gold not so much, but silver blanks. And the Morgan Silver Dollar was a very good example of just that we worked very hard to get the legislation done. None of us knew that we were going to be hit with COVID in the middle of all that. And COVID hits, legislation gets passed, and all of a sudden we're responsible with getting as many Morgan Silver Dollars out to the community as possible, to coin collectors. We had a total, when we reviewed all of the Silver Eagles that were coming out and the new design, the old design, the Morgans, we had to allocate. And for the Morgan, we had a total of 1,075,000 to go out, which was 175,000 per design. And as you know, and as many coin collectors know, because I heard from a lot of them who couldn't get them, we sold out quite rapidly. And then we sold out quite rapidly of the new design, the first and the last strikes of the new design, all of which happened during COVID. Do I wish we could have manufactured more? Sure. But I was hamstrung because of the shortage. I think at the end of the day, we created a number of rarities. I think the secondary market has benefited from that. And I think, you know, I think overall the United States Mint did a pretty admirable job under fairly difficult circumstances.
Well, speaking of rarities, you know, and I think it goes without saying, Director Ryder, that the numismatic community, you're sort of a beloved figure as far as mint directors go in the community for all the collector first initiatives that you undertook, and the way you put yourself out in front of the community. You were always signing autographs, and you're a visible presence at many of our national coin shows. But I do think that there was one program that took place during your term that perhaps you would go back and do differently, because I think there is some rightful criticism of it. And that was the Privy marked 1945 or 75th anniversary Eagle program. Yeah. And I think the issue that many collectors had with that program is that there were basically the rarest silver eagles in the series and gold eagles in the series were released, and collectors felt like they really never had a shot at purchasing them because the mint didn't put them up for auction like they eventually did with the type one, type two silver and gold eagles. They were sold through the mint's website, and the prices of that product, you know, basically exploded upon release. So would you go back and do that program differently? Do you think you maybe underestimated, or the mint underestimated, the demand for these privy marked coins?
If you think back during that time, that was one of the first programs that we did. When I came back to the mint really hadn't released anything special for 8 years because there was no mint director there. There was quite a void. And when I started, you know, I approached the mint from a business perspective, not a government bureaucracy. I was running a government bureaucracy, but I really approached it from a business point of view. And that was one of the first programs that we did. And we spent a lot of time talking about the mintage level, and we came up with 75,000. And quite frankly, the marketing staff at the time thought that was very sufficient. We really didn't have marketing data that would have told us that was wholly inadequate. The goal, I think it was 1,945 to go along with the date, was one of the reasons we did that. Was that too low? Absolutely. If I look back in hindsight, both were too low. But at the time, I didn't have a lot to go on. I probably should have done more due diligence within the community. I didn't. But at the end of the day, a lot of the collectors, rightfully so, were quite upset. There were several people had talked about it. I have received numerous letters about it. Would I do it differently? Sure, absolutely. Hindsight's, you know, 50-50. I would have done it differently. But those that got them in the secondary market, as you said, it jumped up quite dramatically. And those that got them were very lucky. Those that didn't, such as myself and others, were also unlucky. But as a Mint director, I wasn't allowed to buy any of them anyway, so I wasn't going to get it anyway.
Well, one program that you did introduce that was wildly popular was the W Mint circulating coin program with the quarters. Did you feel that, the West Point Mint was already producing circulating coins as an overflow for the Philadelphia facility, had been doing that for decades. Do you feel that like this is a very low cost, but high return program to have sort of an Easter egg coin program out in circulation?
When we came up with that program, one of the things that I realized very quickly when I became Mint director the second time is when I was Mint director the first time, we had well over 2 million active Mint customers. When I came back the second time, that number had shrunk to a very low number, well below 500,000. And one of my goals in creating a lot of these programs was to try to create new young collectors. I think you would probably agree with me that most collectors today are old guys like myself. And the coin collecting community for a long time before I got there didn't have anything to collect. So we created that program specifically for young kids. And I think it was wildly successful. I think people are still trying to find the W quarters out there in circulation. And it was specifically done to create a opportunity for kids to go back and start a collection. And similarly to that, the reason we did our quarter program to go 4 years American Famous Women, 1 year to redesign all the nation's circulating coins, and then another four and a half years or so to do youth sports tied to the U.S. Olympics in 2028, again, was to allow kids to have the ability to collect. So most kids during the 12-year quarter programs, they were young kids when they started, but they're going to college by the time it finished. And so in creating lower years programs, 4 years, 1 year, 4.5 years, 5 years, give or take, was to allow kids to start collecting and finish a collection before they went off to school and finished their collection. So I spent a great deal of time, as did the Mint staff, marketing staff, on creating those special programs that were targeted for young kids to get them interested in our hobby.
All right, before I let you go, I want to do sort of like a little lightning round. I want the first anecdote or memory that comes to your mind of you visiting any of each of the Mints and Branch Mint facilities. So I'll start with the Mother Mint in Philadelphia. Like, what's a memorable moment that you had while you were Mint director at the Philadelphia Mint?
Getting to know, number one, no question about it, getting to know the employees there. There's a lot of great employees that worked their butts off during COVID that I got to know. And I remember one gentleman, and I got to know a lot of them by name. I won't mention their names here, but I spent a lot of time in Philadelphia. I went there quite often. I toured that facility backwards and forwards. I went all throughout that facility. And I got pretty friendly with a number of the machinist that produced our coins. And I remember one guy coming up to me one day and says, "Hey, Director Ryder, guess what kind of car I got?" And we would talk about cars. We would talk about, I'm a woodworker, so I love making small boxes and jewelry boxes and things like that, which are turning into coin boxes now. And we would talk about woodworking programs. It definitely, no question, was getting to know the Mint staff there in Philadelphia. I really enjoyed my time, and they taught me so much about this industry and how to make coins and learn from their experience. It's a great group of people.
All right. Granted, we may have the same story about every facility, but let's move up to West Point. What's your
West Point? West Point. A lot of people don't know this, but West Point is one of those facilities. You think Fort Knox has a lot of gold in West Point, but Ellen up there that runs West Point has been there for a long time. She runs that place like an iron fist, and I always was very careful not to step on Ellen's toes at the West Point Bullion Depository. But I always enjoyed to go up there. It was right in the West Point Military Academy, which I always stayed at the hotel, their hotel on the academy. I always walked back and forth sometimes to the Mint when I could, and it was it's a beautiful facility, a lot of history. I could probably tell you a couple stories about that facility, but I'd probably get in trouble from a security point of view, so I won't go down that road. But it's a great facility, and Ellen and Tom DeNardi run that place like an iron fist, and they're the ones responsible for producing all the bullion and getting it out on time, and they do a fabulous job.
Let's go to that Rocky Mountain State of Colorado and the Denver Mint.
Denver Mint. Randy Johnson runs that place also. I always loved going to the Denver Mint because it's close to my home where I grew up in Montana and Idaho. Randy became a pretty good friend. I remember going one day, again, to see the employees, and I put on a pair of bib overalls, I think it was, and I ended up working on a couple of the presses with a couple of the machinists taking dies out. I remember oiling up or a forklift that we used to use, that they used to move coins around. So I spent a lot of time in Denver with the employees learning their trades. I spent a lot of time, as you get the message, at all these facilities with the employees learning their trades. And it was a lot of fun. It's amazing what you learn with someone who's been doing something for 30 years and you're the boss and you come in and they give you a great deal of respect. But I got down and dirty with the folks in Denver quite a number of times.
I'm pretty sure people who work hard for a living have a lot of similarities, but there must be like a different culture in the Philadelphia and the Denver facility. Do they look at each other as rivals, or do they just sort of go about their business, like sort of not really thinking about how they fit in?
No, I'm sure there's a little rivalry going on there. I mean, it's I used to tease them about it and so on and so forth. Philadelphia being the largest mint, Denver, trust me, Denver holds up their fair share. They make a ton of coins, millions of coins. What's impressive is both staffs focused on, you mentioned it earlier, but focused on quality control. Both of those organizations, well, all of the organizations really focused on quality control. And when you're producing that many coins that quickly, and that many dies are required and professional staff required to get it done, it's quite impressive, the output that they have and the quality that they have. It's always impressed me.
All right, last one, the San Francisco Mint.
San Francisco Mint. Well, I'll tell you a little secret about the San Francisco Mint. One of the programs that I didn't get done that I wanted to get done before I left when the Biden administration came in was I wanted to create, and I hope the Mint does this. This is a big shout out to the Mint marketing staff because I think the coin collecting community would love it. But I wanted to create a set of bar gold out of the San Francisco Mint. I wanted to call it the 49ers bar gold. Manufactured in San Francisco and create several different weights, but create a very clever design and create bar gold from the United States Mint. That's one of the things I really wanted to get done, but I never got done.
Sort of harking back to when it was the assay office in the 1850s, huh?
Yeah, and the San Francisco gold rush and so on and so forth. I still think it's a pretty good idea, and I wish the Mint would do it.
Well, Director Ryder, thank you so much for spending an hour with us and a lot of many insightful looks into the Mint and its operations in your time there. And on behalf of the numismatic community, thank you for giving back so much of your time to collectors and giving them a Mint that really like cared about their wants and their needs and helped grow the hobby in your time.
You know, I just got back from Berlin with Asset, and I spent a lot of time with a lot of old friends, with a lot of the big global mints and the smaller mints. And I was surprised at how many people remembered the old guy, Dave Ryder, but I had a great time there. Saw a lot of great people. And I do like giving back to the numismatic community. I think the United States Mint is the biggest and the best and will always be that way. And our collectors, I think I irritated a few of them sometimes with some of the lower numbers, but I created a pretty healthy secondary market. And thanks to you, Charles, for all that you do. And I appreciate you having me on.
All right. Well, have a great rest of your week. And thank you very much.
All right. Thank you.